is the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network.
Back to Horror Queers. We're talking fine dining, we're talking chainsaw chase scenes, and we're talking motherfucking business cards. And I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace, and we're talking lots of threesomes. And by lots, I mean two, which is more than most movies have.
This is true. And ones that get you a lot of trouble with the MPAA.
Yes! Okay, sorry. We're talking American Psycho, everybody.
Happy 20th, American Psycho!
Happy 20th anniversary. By the time this episode drops, it's going to be 6 days from now. It's April 14th. So that's cool.
Prep your chainsaw.
I mean, prep your chainsaw. Okay, I'll do that. I'll get my little buzzer going. We're talking American Psycho. It's going to be super fun. But before we dive into the film, we do have a guest here. And it's someone that I'm personally very excited about. Joe, I know you don't care that much.
Don't give two shits. Nope.
Ladies and gentlemen and everyone in between, you might know him as the co-creator of the superb trashterpiece known as Ringer, the Sarah Michelle Gellar TV show from the CW a couple years ago. Great one-season wonder. And he is also one of the co-writers of The Perfection, which, as many of you know, is my favorite film from last year, horror or otherwise. Please welcome Eric Carmelo.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being here.
Well, I don't have much else to do. I mean, considering that we're all on lockdown, so it was easy to squeeze it in.
It's so bizarre. I'm finding myself like, and I had to like amp up for this recording because I think just being home constantly, like, I think it's finally starting to hit me where I'm like, oh, I'm not going through a depression, but like I'm feeling like a lack of motivation for anything that's productive.
Yeah, even just getting dressed, I mean, that's a chore.
I actually have found that if I force myself to actually shower and treat it like a normal workday, it's easier for me to get in the swing of things. But if I don't shower, I will not do anything.
Yeah, it's a good coping strategy. There's lots of good things that people should think about doing, like make your bed, stick to a schedule in terms of like when you're eating and what you're going to eat. But yeah, it's an unusual time.
Well, and hopefully by the time this episode drops, we'll be better. I mean, I don't think that's going to be the case, but...
Oh, no. It'll be after Easter, so your country is, like, totally going to be back on track. You'll all be back to work.
Back in church, you know. Oh, Lord. God save us all. Yeah, exactly.
It's fine. So, Eric, okay.
Yes?
We sent you a list of movies to cover, and you immediately gravitated towards American Psycho. Why is that?
I mean, I think just the tone of it really has always been my sweet spot. Both Nicole and I have always loved darkly comic, really subversive things, you know, and especially things that are, you know, make some sort of social commentary. So, and not to mention, like, Jesus Christ, why am I forgetting his name? For the love of God. Who plays Patrick Bateman? Jesus Christ!
Christian Bale, it's okay.
I'm not drunk, I swear. No, I mean, he's like, he's naked through half the film. So I remember seeing it when it came out, and it was 2000, right?
Yes, 2000.
And Nicole and I saw it at a theater in West Hollywood called the Sunset Five, that at the time it was like a Lemley kind of like art house studio. And I just remember we both left that movie just kind of like at a loss for words. I mean, it hit so many of our sweet spots that I didn't even know how to process it when I saw it. Because it was like the first movie I saw that I felt jealous that I didn't write.
I confess, I rewatching it today, I was like, I wonder. I mean, because we'll get into the reception in a bit, which is great. But I wonder, like, just normal audiences going to see this movie. Even through the first 20 minutes, I'm just imagining people just sitting there like, what the fuck am I watching? I don't even know.
Yeah. As a person who was casually going to movies in the year 2000, I went to see this with a relatively packed audience, and the reception was exactly that. People left the theater with a kind of stunned, what the fuck was that? people were very, very confused by the end of this film. They didn't know what to make, whether it was all a dream or if he had actually been committing the murders. And we'll talk about that as well. But yeah, it was very confusing for people who thought that they were just going to go and see like a serial killer film.
Well, that's the thing, though. You know, like I think when I first watched this and I was probably in high school, I was very much bothered by the lack of resolution for the ending. Now I'm watching, I'm kind of like, okay, everything means nothing. That's my takeaway from this movie.
Yeah.
Have y'all read the book? Oh, I guess we're burying the lead here. So this, in case y'all don't know, it is based on a book written by terrible human being, Bret Easton Ellis.
Terrible gay human being, too.
Oh, I know!
He's a bad gay.
I spent a Thanksgiving with him and Rose McGowan once in Palm Springs.
Oh no! My God.
Wait, that must have been some dinner conversation.
That's a whole other episode.
Okay, so tell us about the dinner, though. So were they seated next to each other? Did they talk?
It was at my buddies, Josh and Mark. They have a place in Palm Springs. I think it's like the old Sinatra estate or like some one of the Rat Packers owned this home. Boosh. And it was, let's see, I think it was the Wednesday before we were all there and we were drinking and playing this game called Mafia. Have you ever played that?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes, I have. Yeah. It's like one of you's the murderer, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I just remember him being very well spoken and a little bit reserved, but, you know, fiercely intelligent, kind of funny. And Rose was obviously very outspoken and funny as well. Honestly, I mean, that was the only time that I had ever met them, but they both were, at the time, lovely human beings. So I can't say a bad thing about either of them.
Yeah, oh, and we're not definitely not asking you to. Wait.
But it was surreal. It was surreal. It really was.
Well, so I'd like to think that Patrick Bateman is basically some version of Ellis himself. I just just saying that he's well spoken and hyper intelligent. I'm like, oh, he's just writing about himself. That makes sense.
Yeah. I don't know. If you read interviews with him, he very much says that it's him reminiscing or thinking back to his time in the 80s as like a well-spoken, wealthy man, but he was observing this kind of Brat Pack, Trump-like figures working on Wall Street and just, he looks at it as like, I was the gay on the outside kind of looking in, and this is his satire of what he was seeing and how ridiculous they were. So I don't know if he would agree with your statement.
The satire is something I picked up on way more on this viewing than I have in any previous viewing before that. I mean, it's definitely a mishmash of genres. I think it balances. So, full disclosure, I'm very lukewarm on this film. I think it's I think it's expertly made. I think what it's trying to do, it does very well. I think everyone's great in it. But because, and I get that this is by design, because the film is so cold, like they're so...
It's like, sterile.
Yes. It's just like, by the time the credits roll, I'm just kind of like, I feel deflated almost. And again, I get that that's probably by design, but it's not one where I can't ever say like, oh, like go watch American Psycho. I love this movie. It's just like, it's not quite for me.
Or even like, oh, it's Friday night. Let's throw an American Psycho.
Well, that's the thing. And there are some parts that are genuinely funny. Fucking Reese Witherspoon and her fucking pig. Like,
oh my God.
But
I'm sure there was a spike of Vietnamese pot-bellied pig sales right after this movie dropped. I guarantee it.
Probably
100%. And I actually think that her breakdown during the breakup scene was like her audition tape for Legally Blonde, because like, the breakup in that movie is basically this scene, but just like times 10.
It's so great. I swear, her fur coat deserves its own credit in this film. Like, her hair and her fur, like, I would watch the movie just for that, truly.
I mean, the costuming for the women is out of control. I love it. It's interesting to note how much difficulty they had sourcing, like, beauty products and costumes for this film because of the controversy, though, right? So, like, what we're seeing is a high culture European clothing as opposed to, like, American designers, because they wanted nothing to do with this.
It actually reminds me a lot of whenever the Dawn of the Dead remake came out, because it's in a mall, but so many outlets and stores refuse to, like, sign off on having their imaging in the film, even though it may just be in the background, because they were like, we don't want like blood splatter coming right. across our sign.
Right, right.
Which makes so more funny. Sense now that there's so many more shootings. But back in the day, it was kind of like, oh, you don't want people to visit your mall for decades to come like they do in the original?
I'm sure this is something that we'll discuss, too, as we get into the tone of the film. But that's the thing, too, is, you know, like this, there was so much controversy around the violence in this film. And arguably, I would say it's not even that gory.
No, it's so tastefully shot. It's
right. It's all off camera. Like, yeah. It really is. Yeah. Like, you have, like, the blood splattering on Patrick's face, but, like, you don't really see any of the graphic violence. You don't.
But when you read about the way that it was, like, controversial, it's the same thing as, like, Basic Instinct and Cruising. It's all right. of these people who were protesting without having seen a lick of footage, right. and they were all pulling from their assumptions of what the final product would be.
Right.
Well, okay, that's probably a good transition then into kind of how this film came to be. So, have y'all read the book that this is based on? Have y'all read American Psycho?
I haven't.
I've read some of his other works, but not specifically this one.
Yeah, I've read Rules of Attraction, which I love, and I love that movie. I read half of this book when I was in high school. And
it's not a good high school book.
Well, okay. So, I mean, basically, like, 95% of the dialogue in this film is, like, word for word from the book. It's so many lists. It is a 400-page book, and it is just listing brand names. Of course, like, my pervy self, I, like, skipped ahead to the threesome scene because I wanted to read about that. But that... when we talk about that scene, it's way more violent in the book. It's very upsetting.
I think the violence in the book in general is just way, way worse, right? Because it's actually graphic as opposed to alluding to.
Yes, yes. But I'll hold off on going into the graphic detail of that until we talk about the scene. But yeah, so, okay, good. So y'all are noobs. I'm half of an expert on the
You're book. A half expert.
From something I read layman. Like 12 years ago. So yeah, basically, this book came out in 1991. The rights were snatched up in 1992. So this was like a hot commodity from the get-go, which is kind of surprising to me. I don't know. I mean, given what it's about, it just seems... I don't know.
Well, it's funny because no publisher initially wanted to publish it, and then when it finally was published, it became a massive sensation, and then the film rights immediately got picked up. So it's just hypocrisy right from the beginning.
Right. Well, I mean, it was provocative, and I'm sure Less Than Zero, that was like a big hit, wasn't it? So, mm-hmm. I mean, just yes. based on that alone, I would assume that, you know, his book rights would get immediately optioned.
That's the thing. I don't think there's been a successful... I mean, this is arguably the best adaptation of a Bret Easton Ellis novel. I don't think there's ever been one, though, that's been commercially successful. Because Less Than Zero was the Robert Downey Jr. one. I think that flopped.
Rules of Attraction definitely flopped.
Definitely flopped.
Right.
There was one called The Informers, which is a garbage movie. That was from like 2009, 2008 or something. Mm. And then this. I've been told that Glamorama is something that I would love, but I've never read it. Mm. I don't know.
I haven't even heard of Glamorama. Okay. Was that his latest book?
I don't think so. No, because someone was telling me to read that in high school.
Oh, okay.
I think it might have been the book he made after this.
Mm. It is 1998. It's set and satirizes the 90s, specifically celebrity culture and consumerism.
Okay. Well.
That just sounds exactly like this.
Similar terrain, yes.
But in the 90s instead of the 80s. Yes. I think that, on the Wikipedia page, Zoolander controversy.
Oh, God. Oh,
Jesus.
That's another episode entirely.
Yeah, we'll leave that to listeners to figure out on their own.
Yeah, oh, exactly. God. So yeah, the rights get snatched up in 1992. Johnny Depp expresses interest in being the lead.
Ooh.
Well, okay, I agree, but...
I mean, Johnny Depp back then
yes,
is different
exactly.
than Johnny Depp now.
I think that would be fine. But then they're talking to Stuart Gordon. Rip, apologies. He has, as of this recording, died last night. Mm. That's terrible. But his deal fell through. Then they had David Cronenberg.
I mean, bear in mind, David Cronenberg got attached to a lot of shit in the 90s because he was super fucking hot at that point. But I don't think that would have been good.
Yes. Okay. So basically... So this is like 3 years of shit going down, deals and happening. The producer, Edward R. Pressman, his name is all over the credits for this film. He goes to Cannes in 1996 to pre-sale distribution rights. during this time, so it didn't work. No one wanted it. But then Mary Harron comes on and replaces Cronenberg as director, and she's writing a script with Guinevere Turner. And, of course, that is the eventual script that would come to fruition here.
And Guinevere's actually in the movie, right? She's the one who's part of the threesome with the prostitute, isn't she?
Yeah, okay. She's the one who gets killed under the sheets.
That's right.
And that I did not know either until today. She's great. I love
her. Is great.
And she and Mary Harron have gone on to work on a number of different projects, including their most recent one, which is Charlie Says, about Charlie Manson.
Mm. Yes, I've heard it's actually pretty decent. But yeah, it's definitely, they come as a team, which is probably appropriate that we have Eric on this podcast. So sad we couldn't have Nicole, though. But since y'all tend to work together, it's probably relatable. But I did want to point out that this is not really relevant, but Guinevere Turner does have like one solo screenwriting credit without Mary Harron, and it's the script for Uwe Boll's Blood Rain.
Oh no.
I just in her oeuvre, it just sticks out. I was like, what? That can't be right. It is 100% correct.
So she works best with a female sensibility is what we're hearing.
Yes. I need to see Blood Rain because, again, if she wrote the script, maybe the script is fine, but Boll, everything else is terrible. I don't know.
It's the best of all of his films, but that doesn't mean anything.
Okay, so Harron cast Christian Bale in a deal on good faith. They had gotten Willem Dafoe. They gotten Jared Leto. Sorry, I think I skipped some stuff. Did I, skip over all of the...
No, because they cast everything and then it falls apart. Right.
Yeah, so all this comes together. This is like 1996, 1997. Lionsgate gets distribution rights in April of 97. And so basically after all, this takes a year. All this shit takes a year. Bale and Harron are kind of like, all right, let's get going. And they're ready to start filming in August of 1998 on a $6 to $10 million budget.
Ridiculous. Can you imagine six fucking million dollars to make this movie? Well, fuck off.
I don't know if you saw it, but the final budget, $7 million.
Yeah, it's insane. It's insane given the context about what you're about to reveal in terms of money.
Yes. So Lionsgate, because I was shocked to see that the logo for Lionsgate was still the old school Lionsgate. It's not the one with all the gears. It's the actual, lion. So basically, they were like, Christian Bale's not a big enough star. So they wanted either Edward Norton or Leonardo DiCaprio for Patrick Bateman.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Sophie's Choice. If you had to pick either one of those, which one do y'all think would be better?
Edward Norton, obviously.
See, I was going to say DiCaprio.
No. DiCaprio is if you want to sell the movie to 15-year-old girls because he's coming off of Titanic.
Duh. No, you're right. I'm thinking of present-day DiCaprio, not 1997 DiCaprio.
He was a
twink, yes.
I mean, I love a good twink, but...
American twink.
Oh my god, American twink. There's your movie.
But then you have to cast Mina Suvari in it, as we've discussed before.
Oh my god. Lionsgate. So basically, though, Harron's kind of pissed off about that. Lionsgate's still trying to work out a deal with her. Because Bale wasn't officially signed on, it was a handshake deal with Harron. Lionsgate had the right to do this. To be like, fuck that. She didn't like either one of their options, obviously. For DiCaprio, for the reasons y'all just said. He was too twinky, he was a teenage girl magnet, and this movie isn't really meant for teenage girls, unless you're into this kind of stuff, which is fine. But here's the weird thing. They want to increase the budget to $40 million because, and get this fucking shit, DiCaprio had a $21 million asking price.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable.
It's just ridiculous.
But they weren't going to increase the budget of the film. They were just going to give all that money to him, which would have automatically given him all of the creative control and leverage on the film. And 100% would have guaranteed that this film would have been rewritten. His image would have been protected. It would have been a completely different film.
Well, and this is the thing, too. So at Cannes the next year, 1997, a press release goes out that actually said DiCaprio had taken the offer. And then immediately his manager had to come out and be like, nope. Not true. He is just interested in the part, but he is not officially signed on. But then here's where it kind of gets weird. So DiCaprio apparently didn't know about how long that Bale and Harron had been working on this film, or at least to get it off the ground. So he basically was like, I don't want Mary Harron. He wanted to either bring in Oliver Stone, Danny Boyle, or Martin Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure, don't we all? I don't want to work with this one-time female director. I want to work with literally legendary directors or the hottest up-and-coming guy. The fucking hubris.
I love this about Heron. Apparently, there is a direct quote pulled from her where she basically says that Oliver Stone would have probably been the single worst person to do it. And I'm like, good for you. Because, a female director speaking out like that in the late 90s, that might have, been really bad for her.
Oh, and she fell on the sword for Bale, because she actually walked away from this when they said, you can't have him. And she was like, fine, fuck you. I probably just scorched earth my own career, but I'm leaving unless I can get this guy.
Well, and then that would have happened. She would have been gone. But Stone would not agree on the film's direction with DiCaprio, so they couldn't agree. And so DiCaprio went on to do The Beach instead with Danny Boyle.
Mm-hmm. So he got what he wanted, and then he worked with Scorsese on Wolf of Wall Street.
But then this is the shitty thing. Lionsgate is still not, ready to accept Christian Bale, so they make an offer to Ewan McGregor, who turned it down because he knew Christian Bale, and Bale told him, please don't take that role.
Jesus.
Wow.
Well, and they had just worked together on Velvet Goldmine, so I'm pretty sure they were thick as thieves at that point.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I was going to say, what movie had Christian done just prior to this, and why was he considered such box office poison?
It's not that he
or
was
not
poison.
A big enough name.
He just wasn't famous enough he became known when he was 13 for being in Empire of the Sun. That's his big thing.
And Newsies.
Newsies.
Every gay boy is like, Newsies.
I've actually never seen Newsies. I have no desire to, but
yeah, it's cute.
Because yes, Newsies is the big one. And, oh my god, Empire of the Sun, Henry V, Newsies, Swing Kids, oh, Little Women, he was in the, he played Laurie. Mm.
Oh, that's right.
But being cast in Little Women, that's not the kind of role that's going to be oh, this guy can convincingly play a crazy murderer.
Right.
Right.
Going from basically America's boyfriend to America's serial killer.
I think Velvet Goldmine's probably the best example of kind of craziness for him. But then, so he did that in 97, and then he was Demetrius in The Midsummer Night's Dream with Rupert Everett in 99.
Hmm.
That's really about all he had done. So, he doesn't have, I can see why Lionsgate's oh, we're going to go with DiCaprio. Nope. Ewan McGregor. Nope.
Nope. Shit. I guess that kid from Newsies?
Yeah.
This is Christian Bale's big breakout as an adult.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, this made him... honestly, I have issues with Bale in general just because... remember when he was doing Terminator Salvation and that thing leaked about his... he was yelling at a light tech and whatever?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's right.
Ever since that. And you can look at a video of it. And granted, the light tech was really just being intrusive on the scene. But his blow up, ooh. I can't really. It's like Russell Crowe beating a concierge with a phone, you know? I just never look at people the same way after that. Because I'm like, oh, you don't treat people like humans. So.
Right.
Right.
But.
Apparently he is a little bit challenging on set as well. He's definitely one of those 100% method actors. So yeah. He was terrifying and very distant on set because he was trying to remain in this headspace the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm sure he and Jared Leto got along swimmingly.
Where do you think Jared Leto got it from?
Did you hear that he started a cult? No joke.
Jared Leto. Yeah.
Wait, today, now?
Yeah, the last couple of weeks.
Yeah. Well, first he didn't know that the coronavirus was even a thing because he was
he was on a meditation retreat.
Exactly. But I think some of the people that he was on the retreat with, they all started a cult and they're on some island now. So
yeah, he asked them to call him something gross and weird.
Yeah, I'll see if I can find the article, but it's hysterical and it totally makes sense.
That's okay.
He's basically somewhere between, he's cribbed career moves from Christian Bale with all the weird roles that require him to lose weight and gain weight and to be a method actor. And then he's also taking, life advice from Charlie Manson's?
Yeah.
Oh no, sorry, the Vampire Lestat. That's what
you're thinking. Side note, and you can cut this out, I think this is really funny. So he did a voice in the Disney's Pocahontas, the animated one, but then he also played John Rolfe in Terrence Malick's The New World.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god.
Christian Bale's versatile, man.
Yes.
Animation, indeed. Live action, he does it all. So, yeah, basically, the movie got made because they were like, fine, fucking put Bale in this movie and we'll give you a budget of $7 million.
Yeah, it was like, we're going to give you $0 to make this movie, but sure, make it your way.
Yeah. So I'll just dive into reception and release at this point. So, yes, American Psycho released on April 14th, 2000 by Lionsgate. We're looking at a runtime of 101 minutes or 102 if you watch the unrated cut of the film, which I did, and a budget of $7 million. Now, it did not do well in theaters, but it did make its money back. It opened at number 7 with $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
So in hindsight, making a $40 million budget was probably a good idea.
Yeah, this was never going to be a big blockbuster hit. The source material alone guarantees that it's going to be both controversial and very off-putting to a certain percentage of people.
Well, and I think, I want to say maybe it was Cronenberg's version that was going to be like exactly like the novel, but then maybe Stone's version was going to be like very different, or maybe I'm having those in reverse, but like one of them was going to be like exactly like the novel, so it was like too much, and then the other one was going to be like a huge departure. And also I feel like if you do like a blockbuster version of this, I don't want to say watered down, but like it's going to lose the edge.
Yes.
Yeah. You're either going for snuff film or you're going safe.
Yeah, exactly. So I do think that this is probably the best version of an adaptation of this novel we would have gotten. So, you know, small things. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it went on to gross $15 million domestically and an international gross of $19.2 million for a worldwide total of $34.2 million. I mean, it made over 4 times its money back, so that's that. I mean, it's fine.
Something. I think the legacy of this film is definitely
Bale.
The cultural impact that it had. Yeah, it relaunched Bale. It really announced to a lot of people that Mary Harron was a director who could handle difficult material, and like kind of like the other Mary who makes really good films, Mary Lambert, we maybe shouldn't be shitting on female directors who make genre films.
Right. I think Mary Harron's gone on to at least do more work. In terms of film, like in Hollywood, you know?
Yeah. Lambert makes a lot of music videos.
Yes, which, good for her. I mean, I think she did a bunch of Madonna. Like, she did, like a Prayer, like a Virgin, maybe
she
both,
did.
I don't know.
And Open Your Heart, the Peep Show video. I think that was her first video she did with Madonna. Or maybe she also did Borderline, too. I know she's done a bunch for her, so.
Maybe, but Pet Sematary 2 was the nail in the coffin for her. Because she got one extra shot, and because it didn't do well, she was, you know, not good enough for Hollywood, apparently.
Jesus Christ.
I know. It's real shitty. And when Harron, too, I mean, she does make films, but she's done mostly, like, indie films, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
She's been doing TV, though, lately, too, hasn't she, Trace? Mary's been directing a lot of TV, I think.
Yes, yeah.
I think you are correct.
Did she do the Alias Grace miniseries?
Yes, she did. I'm almost positive she did. And she's done just a lot of episodic TV, too, where a lot of female directors are working, thank God.
I mean, we had a discussion about Neil Marshall the other day, Joe, and it's like, yeah, Neil Marshall isn't really making films anymore because he's doing Game of Thrones. He's got that HBO money.
Right.
I mean, anymore. But I think because now in the era of peak TV, because TV isn't looked upon as a death curse like it was back in the 90s and early 2000s, you're seeing more prolific talent go behind the camera of TV shows now, and it's kind of bizarre, but at the same time, like, you know, you still wish, like, I would love to see like a mainstream Mary Harron film coming out like today.
Me too.
So yeah, we are looking at a 69% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a bit lower than I thought, an average score of 6.31 out of 10, but the Letterboxd score, we're looking at a 7.8 out of 10, so those people got it right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This 100% seems like the kind of film that would lose people on a first viewing, and then people would come to appreciate it. Like, there's a very funny anecdote that apparently when the film debuted at Sundance, Mary Harron was supposed to have dinner with Kevin Smith, and he bailed on her because he hated the film so much he didn't know how to interact with her without offending her. And it wasn't until, like, years later that he came back around and was like, oh, sorry, I saw the film again, and I've totally reappraised it, and I think it's genius.
Well, all right, before we go into the plot, then, that's probably important, because I didn't watch the trailer before we started doing this, but I don't know if Lionsgate knew how to market this film. Apparently, like, they did, like, a bunch of, like, gimmicky promotional campaigns where you could receive emails from Patrick Bateman that were going to his therapist. Yeah, The emails would like describe or mention interactions with other characters from the novel. And basically, Christian Bale was pissed because he was like, some people actually thought that he was the one returning the emails. Oh, 2000. But I think that they were trying to push it as a slasher flick. And yeah. Both Heron and Bale were like, that's not what we're doing. It's satire. And so, I don't know. I can see this being a film like you would probably do, Joe, where it's like you walk in expecting a slasher movie and then you get this. And so I can see a lot of people, yeah, being like, that's not what I wanted or expected.
Yeah.
Right. But marketing wise, I understand why they would want to market it as a slasher flick. You know, I mean, if I were in a marketing department, I don't think I would market it as a, you know, darkly comic indictment of yuppie culture. You know, I feel like that's so niche that you would want to market it as a slasher flick.
Here's an anti-capitalist film. Let's not market it that way because we don't want to piss people off.
I mean, that's the thing, too, though, is like this film is so steeped in late 80s New York culture. And
right.
I could see it being alienating to some viewers, too, who are like, I don't understand any of this.
I mean, definitely younger viewers who hadn't lived through the 80s or weren't aware of, like, I could imagine people not understanding all of the bullshit with the business cards. They'd just be like, what is going on here? Why are they so interested and invested in this?
I will tell you right now that when I first saw that film, I did not get it. I was like, what? They're all the same. And obviously,
that's the point. That's the point.
I mean, really, this movie might as well just be called Doppelgangers the Movie. Because fucking everyone is interchangeable.
Yeah. The core set of guys, it's Jared Leto, it's, oh my god, I'm pulling in Eric. Christian Bale.
Josh Lucas. Yeah.
Oh, I know, and I hate Josh Lucas so much. He has never done anything for me, and I hate him in almost everything he does.
Well, because he always plays a smarmy prick. He's really good at it.
Unless he's romancing Reese Witherspoon in Sweet Home Alabama, and he sucks there, too.
This is true.
He does.
But he was great in that Firm show on NBC for one season.
Oh, God, I forgot that was even a show. You're right. You're right.
So fucking bad. It was so bad.
I mean, he wasn't awful in the Poseidon Adventure. I mean... Well, maybe
Poseidon
he was.
Remake.
I don't know. Yes, Poseidon? Yes. Poseidon, yes. Yeah.
So, yes. What were we talking about?
Josh Lucas sucking and everything. Yeah.
God, he sucks so bad.
All right. Let's do this, people.
Okay.
So, the credits play over a selection of gorgeous-looking fine dining, which confirms that Brian Fuller totally ripped this off for Hannibal.
Yes.
My first note.
But I will say, this whole opening sequence, and it reminded me so much of the opening sequence of My Best Friend's Wedding. Because it's Julia Roberts, so she's a food critic, and she's in a restaurant, and you're like watching all this food go around. That's what this reminded me of.
Was that before or after this? I can't remember what year My Best Friend's Wedding came out.
I think 97,
1997,
right?
Baby.
97, okay.
Yeah. Okay. I think the thing I like about the scene is that it tells you everything that you need to know about these guys in a single scene. They're yuppies, right. They're rich, they do coke, they have no ability to recognize anyone who's more than a foot away from them because they're just continually misconstruing who's surrounding them in this restaurant, and they're obsessed with like capitalism and brand imagery. It's like very effectively done.
It is. But I think all the scenes in this movie are. It's very lean and mean, and it has a driving force that, I don't know, I think the way that it's paced and plotted, it's very effective.
I completely agree with you. Mm-hmm. It's hilarious to me, though, because I've seen people complain that there's nothing to this movie because it's all just scenes of them going out to eat, them at a nightclub, Patrick at home, Patrick murdering somebody, and I'm like... Yes, it's called mundane routine reality. That's literally what the movie is deconstructing. Yeah. Okay, so after we're introduced to this group of assholes, we go to a nightclub. And this is where we get our first glimpse that Patrick Bateman, played by Christian Bale, is not altogether right. Because when a bartender doesn't serve him his drink in the way he likes it, he immediately tells her that he's envisioning killing her. Little grim.
I like that humor in this movie a lot. Like, there's a lot of like, I'm gonna fucking kill you, like so much. It's just, it's very delightful. And the glee that Bale delivers those lines in, it's just, it's infectious.
That's the combination of his delivery and the fact that no one ever hears him. No one ever hears the things that he's actually saying. Like, it doesn't matter what he says. He can tell people exactly what he wants to do, and people are just like, what? What'd you say? Didn't hear you.
Because they're all too self-involved to care. I mean, yeah.
It's a bit of a scathing indictment of New York as well. Not regarded.
100%.
We can say this because we're not from New York. Okay, so the next day, Patrick begins his morning regimen, which is literally just him telling us his routine and all of the products that he uses in excruciatingly specific voiceover. And it's all anti-aging. It's all about physical aesthetics because, of course, he tells us that he is simply not there. There's nothing underneath the facade that he is wearing.
Now, this whole sequence is pretty iconic for this film, though, and it's so hypnotic, but I gotta say, the face peel's really gross.
Oh, yeah. It's so gooey. There's, like, it's gelatinous, right?
Yeah. And I get it. It's deep. He's peeling off his mask, his face, blah, blah, blah. His identity is missing. I get it. It's fine.
You know, Trace, for somebody who likes facials, you're pretty sensitive about goop on the face here.
I know. Well, no, that's the thing. Like, I don't like sticky things unless it's in the moment. You know, it's like some people, they don't like dirty talking unless it's in the moment. That's kind of how I am with bodily fluids.
Right. You only like your face mask in the moment. Got it.
Yes. when I can't see it coming. Oh!
Keep your eyes closed.
It was ahead of its time, though. I mean, who knew that, like, facial peels would become such a thing?
I mean, that's the funny thing, right? Is you're watching it and you're thinking, oh, we've all done, like, a face peel or a face mask. Or some people have even gone to the spa and gotten the chemical peel. Ugh.
Yeah,
but this is not that, right? This is, like, a precursor to all that.
Correct. Correct.
That's the thing, though, right? Though, like, because I know that this is set in 87. Do they ever say that in the film that it's set in the 80s?
I think you're just meant to infer it based on the fashion and the way
aesthetic
that,
and everything.
Yeah, the telephones. Right. And
they reference Reagan and, you know, yeah.
Right, yes.
There's something about the, just like the visual aesthetic of the film. Like, sometimes I felt, specifically in the scenes with the four businessmen, sometimes I felt like it was shot in Technicolor. Like, something looked artificial about the coloring of this film sometimes.
I almost feel like it's because certain things pop because everything else is so flat and dull.
Correct. But that was like an 80s aesthetic, you know, like you would wear like the muted colors or the black and with the pops of red. And yeah. I just feel like that was just kind of the palette of the 1980s.
This is true. Eric, at some point, we're going to get you to mention a little bit about your love of Looker, but like not everything can have the pink, tan, and taupe aesthetic of Looker.
I forget, we're really having an Eric Carmella month with that fucking article coming out.
I mean, the song is incredible. I downloaded that song when you could download music back in the late 90s, whenever that started. But
oh, I'm sure.
I remember looking it up.
I'm imagining baby Eric being like, Napster, Looker.
That's right. Yes. You 100% right.
So and now I'm going to wait 3 days for this to download.
Right. The good old days.
So speaking of music, let's do a little cut to Walking on Sunshine by Katrina and the Waves. As Patrick heads into the office, I will say, I forgot how great the soundtrack to this movie is.
Oh, it's
I mean,
fantastic.
I know that he's meant to be obnoxious with his music selections, but I kind of still love it.
I think that I read that the biggest chunk of the budget went to purchasing the rights for the songs.
Yeah, oh, I was going to say that. I bet $2 million of that $7 million went toward music rights. Crazy.
Fucking
but
Phil
yeah,
Collins.
I mean, it's, oh my God, it's amazing.
Susio, motherfucking Susio. So at this point, we are introduced to Patrick's assistant, Jean, who's played by Chloe Sevigny. And
I'm Chloe Sevigny, and I like Toast.
Totally don't get that reference.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Okay, sorry. There's this man named Doge. Yes.
Yes.
And he. Oh God, Joe. I'm surprised you've never seen these. He has videos from like the late 2000s, early 2010s, where he just dresses up in drag as Chloe Sevigny, and
it's really the best thing ever. Oh
it's
my
so
God!
So funny.
Is he like Tom Lenk?
Yeah, kind of Tom Lankish. Yeah.
Yes, okay. but they're full on like videos. Like there's one on Halloween. She says everything's so weird. It's actually very much like it's a merging of Chloe Sevigny and Patrick Bateman, or like how you think Gwyneth Paltrow is, because all she does is like name drop, like all this. It's, oh my god, it's so funny. Joe, I'm gonna have to like send you like a whole playlist of these videos because you will die.
Okay.
It's really, really funny. He's fiercely talented, that yes, man.
Absolutely.
Exciting. Things to look forward to in the future.
Unfortunately, Chloe Sevigny does not really have much to do in this movie. She's great in it, but she just kind of sits there.
Yeah.
I won't disagree with you, but I think that her role is vitally important. Like, the small amount of screen time that she gets, she is, like, the only person who actually... She both falls for Patrick's bullshit, like so many other characters, but, you know, as the movie proceeds, she's the one who also is the only person who sees beneath the mask.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then we don't really get any satisfaction or any kind of catharsis at the end of the movie, which, again, is the point.
Oh, you're just having a hard time with that today, aren't you?
No, I mean, it's, again, I accept the movie for what it is. It's just like, you know, it's just so, everything about this is so impersonal, but it's fine.
Wow. God, is this what I sound like to you most of the time?
Yep, pretty much.
Ugh, it's unbearable.
It's terrible, I know. I get really angry a lot.
Shut the fuck up.
Okay.
All right. So let's meet Patrick's on-again, off-again girlfriend, Evelyn, played by Reese Witherspoon.
And I was trying to think. I was like, she wasn't really famous by this point, but honestly, she was. I mean,
yeah,
she'd done Freeway and Fear and, like, The Man in the Moon, but then, like, 98, 99, we're looking at fucking Pleasantville, Cruel Intentions, and Election. So she was, mm-hmm. like, I mean, she was climbing the A-list chart at this point.
She was,
yes, she was,
I think, still indie darling, though, right? Because Legally Blonde is the thing that takes her from indie to commercial.
Well,
is that right? No, maybe Cruel Intentions?
I would say Pleasantville and Cruel Intentions are both big studio films.
Yes, agreed.
But, yes, because Tobey Maguire's the lead in Pleasantville, and it's really all about Sarah Michelle Gellar and Cruel Intentions, obviously. Right. So, yes, I think Legally Blonde is when she really broke out as, like, oh, she's a leading lady.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this is doing nothing to help her commercially, but I think it definitely cements her indie credibility, because this film is filled with character actors who are, they're popping up and they're delivering bite-size iconic performances, but at the end of the day, it's very much Christian Bale's film.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. So Patrick and Evelyn are out for dinner with Timothy Brice, who's played by Justin Theroux, who, of course, at this point really wasn't a thing.
Honestly, the first movie I remember seeing him in was Charlie's Angels Full Throttle.
Oh my god.
Where he's the
He
villain.
Was so good in that. Yeah, he was great in that.
He's great. But like I feel like he didn't even hit mainstream really until maybe The Leftovers.
And had he done the David Lynch movie yet? Or was that after?
No.
It was Lost Highway or was it Mulholland Drive?
It's Mulholland Drive.
Mulholland Drive.
And
okay.
It's I think 2001.
Yeah, I think it's right after this.
Yeah, because I remember thinking he was an interesting, like, I didn't remember him being in this film at all. I totally remember him from Mulholland Drive, but it was weird to learn that he was also a screenwriter, because he's one of the co-screenwriters of Charlie's Angels Full Throttle.
And Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, so weird. So fucking weird.
I think that's, hilarious. Yeah, I think that's probably
people's
how
careers,
that.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
It'd be like the person from Ringer going on to make The Perfection. It would just be so fucking weird.
Hilarious.
Love you, Eric.
Love you guys.
Okay, so they are, so they're having a big dinner. This is where we more or less get to know all of the important people that we're going to need to know for this film. So we've got Timothy Brice, Justin Theroux. We've got Patrick's side piece, Courtney Rawlinson, who's played by Samantha Mathis.
Totally forgot she was in this, by the way. Like,
totally forgot.
And her role also kind of comes to nothing.
No. The women in this movie are so fucking sad to me. Evelyn just wants to get married. Courtney just wants to have children. And none of the men in their lives could give two fucks about anything that they care about, which is maybe also the 80s.
Right. And the point, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. I think she may have been cast, though, because she plays the older version of Kirsten Dunst in Little Women, which also starred Christian Bale.
Fuck
That off. Makes sense.
Where is Kevin Bacon in this movie?
I mean, you're talking to the person who only knows Samantha Mathis as being Daisy in the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
I love her. I wish that she would have a comeback. Like, what has she done lately?
She did The Strain. She was in a season of that.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
No one should have wished their worst enemies to go on The Strain.
I know. It's a terrible show.
Didn't Samantha Mathis also star in the Gun Kata movie with Christian Bale?
The Gun Kata movie?
Yeah, the one that's like The Matrix only with guns. What's it? Fuck.
Oh, is it The 13th Floor?
No.
No, that was Gretchen Mol. That's Gretchen Mol. Right?
Damn it. Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, this is all getting cut.
Sorry, that's getting cut out.
I'll leave the Gun Kata stuff in so people can yell at me later.
I don't know what Gun Kata is. I don't understand.
I don't either. I thought you meant Gym Kata, the gymnastics karate movie.
Yes to that. That is amazing. No, Gun Kata is what they classified the type of fighting that happens in the movie. It's like Evolution or like X something. It's basically Fahrenheit 451 meets The Matrix with Christian Bale and Samantha Mathis. Anyway, okay. Not important. So Courtney is engaged to Lewis Carruthers, who is played by Matt Ross. He is sort of the last important member of this group.
And our queer connection. Well, one of them. There's more.
This movie is queer to the gills.
That's okay. Do you think we're going to get accurate? Well, not obviously because idiots don't listen to us, but like the idiots that read our articles that are like, y'all are reaching, meh. Do you think that we would get those accusations? Because I think this movie is super gay.
It's so gay. Like, the homoeroticism to me is like off the charts. I actually thought that Patrick was going to sleep with the Jared Leto Paul Allen character and then kill him. Like, 100% that's what I remembered in this.
Listeners, you might have to like enlighten us on the book. Because in the movie, he is very much disgusted by homosexuality, at least between men. I don't know if he's meant to be bisexual or something in the book. Or if he does any kind of homoerotic things in the book. I'm just wondering if that was maybe cut out or if that was just never part of the plan.
Interesting. Part of it is I see the male posturing, like the peacocking with everything to do with the suits and the business cards and who's going to get into fucking Dorsia. I see that all as dick swinging. I am the bigger man, but also, like, that's why Patrick gets so mad, is because he needs to be the biggest dick in the room, and he's so busy concerning himself with the lives of men that, like, women just don't even matter in this movie.
Dorsia. Okay, so...
Guys, I need to get into Dorsia. Who can help me get a reservation?
The part when he's asking Chloe 70 where she wants to go for dinner, I'm like, oh my god, don't fucking say Dorsia. Don't say Dorsia. Don't say Dorsia!
It's like the mistake that she makes. I feel like he wouldn't have tried to kill her if she hadn't said Dorsia.
So you know how you are with your house porn, Joe?
Yes.
I am a food porn person. Every single dish in this movie was giving me an orgasm. I don't even like, I don't.
The mud soup.
Oh, yes. I wrote that in my notes. I was like, it's like the mud soup. And they love arugula. First, a Caesar salad with arugula, which makes no fucking sense to me.
No, none of the food in this movie actually makes sense. Like, it actually becomes increasingly ridiculous the more that you listen to the things that they're eating.
Uh-huh.
The mud soup and the charcoal arugula. What?
And yet, if you think about it, super prescient, because I don't know about you folks, but we had this run of fucking charcoal, ice cream, and other things here in Canada a couple years ago.
Yeah. It's true. It's supposed to be very good for your stomach, by the way.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, see, they put charcoal in a lot of those like Biore nose strips, because it's supposed to be good for your face.
Oh.
Oh my god, it's another beauty connection. Telling you, finger on the pulse, American Psycho. Okay, so next dangerous thing that we see is Patrick takes out money. We constantly see him taking out money because he's constantly spending money. So he takes out money and then he sees a woman on the street and he hits on her. And then the next day, we just cut to him angrily yelling at the Chinese dry cleaners about a massive red stain on his sheets.
The cranberry juice.
Yes, it's cran apple.
I love that. He can't even be as simple as cranberry. It has to be cran apple. I never realized until this rewatch that literally every subservient person except for the waiters at the high price restaurants, all of the people who serve him, so the people in this dry cleaning, the people that he sees on the streets, like anyone who's in a remotely subservient position is a person of color.
Hmm.
Oh, I did not catch that. Good for you.
Because so much about this movie is about the class, right?
Right.
We haven't gotten to the part where he kills the homeless man, but there's a lot about white privilege and just how materialistic all of these people are, obviously because they're on Wall Street. But the film is also doing this really subtle thing where it's like they're constantly surrounded by people of color serving them. And much like the women, they just don't matter. Like they're not seen
they're
or
invisible.
Interacted with.
Yeah.
Because, I would never call this movie subtle at all, but yes.
you didn't notice.
No, but that's what I'm saying, though. Yeah, that is an example of, like, again, I'm sure on a repeat viewing, or three, you'll notice more of those things.
Yeah. So after the dry cleaning incident, we cut back to Patrick in his apartment. He's watching pornography. Did everybody catch
Love
that
it.
The movie is inside Lydia's ass?
Yes.
Okay, so...
It's a bit of foreshadowing for the threesome scene to come.
I would say more gay shit because he has a fascination with assholes.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's also a straight male thing, though. Think again of Cruel Intentions. What is the one thing that Sebastian can do?
Right.
Oh, right. You can put it anywhere. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, but do you think... Okay, maybe I'm generalizing. Straight listeners, y'all can correct me. Do you really think the straight men are really into rimming?
I think rimming less so.
Yeah,
it's all about sticking the dick in.
Yes, yes. Only true gay men. Oh, wait, nope, not going to say that.
Nope.
Only the best of us go mouth to ass.
That's true. Human centipede it up, folks.
The real American heroes do.
Actually.
We salute your service, rimmers of the world.
Random Kevin Smith thing, because there's a whole line in Clerks 2 whenever Rosario Dawson is like telling them, like, you never go ass to mouth. And I remember thinking that I was like, Kevin Smith, you are better than that. You know that's not true.
Oh, so many people go ass to... Okay, yeah, here we are.
I know!
Back again. Yeah. Okay, so this is our first mention of Dorcia. He tries to get Courtney to come out. She is not feeling up to it because she's incredibly hopped up on lithium, but he convinces her he has gotten seats at Dorcia. He takes her to a completely different restaurant, but she passes it along to her fiancé that they went to Dorcia, and as a result, his stock increases. It's so funny. I can appreciate that people could watch this and miss a lot of the comedy, but if you're paying attention to the satire,
yes,
it's spot on.
Yes.
Well, I also love how she's, like, passing out at the dinner table. Like, she, like, slumps down and just he's just, like, looking at her like, all right.
And he doesn't care.
No.
And he ordered her so much food. I was shock. Yeah. I was like, Jesus Christ, how many courses are you ordering this girl?
When he finished the first course, I was like, okay, well, that sounds appropriate and maybe delicious. And then he keeps going.
Oh, he was just getting started. Yeah. It's hilarious.
I do also love the host laughing at him when he calls to make that reservation. It's just And it goes on and on and on.
I know.
So good.
Very funny.
I like to think the person answering the phone at Dorcia was a big old gay.
I bet that was Brett Easton Ellis. Don't you think?
Oh, maybe.
That would be ideal. I would love that.
We need a gay cackle. Who could we hire?
I mean, all of us are clearly available.
Oh, all the time. So now we are going into the infamous business card scene.
Mm-hmm. Yes, let's go to the business card scene. So Patrick is confused for Marcus, which will come in handy when he wants to cover his tracks later. And the person who mistakes him for Marcus is Paul Allen, played by Jared Leto.
In this weird, like, what would you call his hairstyle? Because I called it a pseudo mullet in my notes.
Yeah, it's like a slick back mullet, you know?
Yeah.
It was.
I would call it, dare I say, Trumpian.
Oh. Yes. There you go.
Like 80s Trump?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Or like Trump Jr. nowadays?
Yeah. No, that's it.
Because it doesn't come out quite as strongly in this film. Like, Trump does get mentioned. Ivanka gets mentioned. I feel like Melania gets a mention. I don't know that she was actually around at the time. Whatever.
I don't think she was, no. No. So, I think... Was she?
I thought it was Ivana. I thought they referenced Ivana, not Melania.
No, there's a Melania mentioned.
There is a Melania that they mentioned, and I remember thinking, like, was he married to Melania at the time? But I don't think that he was.
No, it might just be another famous Melania that they're name dropping.
I feel like Marla Maples was late 80s, or maybe it was still Ivana was still his wife. I don't remember.
Mm-hmm. Because in the book, he's very much a fan. Like, he has Trump's The Art of the Deal on his, nightstand in the book.
Vomit in my face.
Boo, boo, boo.
But, like, how perfect, like, truly, you know, talk about life imitating art.
And then that might make this whole comparison of very same-looking business cards.
Right?
Like, just kind of relevant to that.
Yeah, so in case people were wondering, the competing business card colors that they are all very impressed over are bone, eggshell, pale nimbus white, and then I think an off-white.
The pale nimbus white was my favorite.
I love it.
And y'all will laugh, but as someone who worked with linens a lot when I worked in the wedding industry, that shit is real. Like, y'all try looking through about the different shades of white and off-white.
Mm-hmm. Honey, I watched Say Yes to the Dress. I know.
You think this is a blue. This is cerulean blue.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's exactly right. Meryl Streep in the Devil Wears Prada joke. Yes.
Yeah. So good.
Don't explain my comedy. If they don't get it, they don't get it.
I love Bale's reaction. Like, when he, like, drops the card. It's Paul's card, right, that he looks at?
It's the one he's most impressed with, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's sweating, and fucking Matt Ross is like, are you okay? You're perspiring.
Yeah, like, perspiring could be the worst possible thing these men could do in front of one another. It's a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. So, shockingly enough, the very next scene is Patrick literally berating and then murdering a homeless man who is played by Reggie Cathy.
Ooh, and trigger warning, y'all, in case you haven't watched it yet, this dog dies.
Oh, yeah, I totally forgot about that, too.
Yep.
Not fun times.
But, oh, God, it's... Ooh, I was going to say something that was going to offend my father, and I'm not going to say it, but... It's going to make him look really bad. This is, like, actually the one moment of, like, emotion that I felt watching this movie. And it's just because this poor homeless man is so sad. And he is talking down to him, telling him he smells like shit. It's just, it's so sad. And so this is, like, the one time that I actually felt something in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to watch because you see the man's reaction to what Patrick is saying. You know, he's alternating insults with, I'm going to get you a job. You know what? I can help you out. And you can see the man just desperately clinging to the possibility that he might be able to improve his situation. And then Patrick literally does not care about him. He just murders him. Mm. This is just a body to Patrick. He has no care or interest in this man.
Yeah.
Are we supposed to believe that he has not killed someone before, or he's been doing it? Because I know at the end he says he's killed 20, 40 people, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. I think he had already killed prior to the movie starting, based on kind of what he says at the end, you're just doing like a body count. So, yeah.
Yeah, although we are obviously meant to take what he's saying not quite at face value, but I agree. Correct. The way that he strikes out doesn't suggest it's his first time. And then it's not like we see him panic. I mean, depending on how you want to take it, he's already killed that woman that he met on the street at this point.
Right.
She of the sheets.
And doesn't he also have a lock of blonde hair? Is that another murder that happens after this, or is that
that's
prior
coming
to
up.
This?
That's okay. The model. Gotcha. In the
yes,
in the
that's right. That's right.
Okay, so let's jump ahead to Christmas, where Evelyn debuts a potbellied pig, and Patrick reconnects with Paul Allen. And it happens very quickly. So he meets up with Paul Allen. Paul Allen, again, does not recognize him. He thinks that he's Marcus. They make drunken dinner plans, and then all of a sudden, Patrick and Paul are back at Patrick's apartment. Paul is putting on Huey Lewis and the News, hip to be square. He's putting on a frankly very aesthetically pleasing clear raincoat, and he's got some moves. And then he takes an axe to Paul's face.
Supposedly the dance was improvised.
I can believe it. This apparently was his audition scene, so he had to go to Mary Warren's house in the UK. I mean, he's from the UK, so he probably, took the tube. And apparently she had the windows open, and she made him do it several times, and she was deeply concerned of what her neighbors thought of her.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
But no, this is, I think this is, with the exception of the business card scene and maybe the chainsaw scene, I think this is probably the most well-known scene from the film.
I agree.
It's iconic, for sure.
It's just so fun. And watching that blood spray all over his face. I don't even think we see the body. Like, we see it when he has it in, like, the wrap, when he's putting it in the car, which, great physical comedy there. But, we see the blood. That's it. Mm-hmm. There's no, like, aftermath in this movie.
No. And admittedly, this didn't get them into trouble. It was the sex mixed with violence that got them into hot water.
Was this an original X rating, or was it always R-rated? It was. Okay.
It was X. They had to trim 18 seconds of footage to get the R rating.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So arbitrary.
They shot extra. They did the usual, 80 slasher approach where they shot extra with the anticipation that they would trim to get down to what they really wanted to include. But, I don't think they anticipated that there would be so much outcry about the violence against women, which is really where they get into issues later.
Right.
Which is really funny, considering it's not much.
There's literally it's so nothing tame. There.
I mean, that's what's ironic. I mean, truly, it's... I guess it's kind of like, when they say Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like the violence on screen is so minimal, but people are filling in the blanks with what they're not seeing. So.
Which is literally a joke in this motherfucking movie.
Right.
I know.
That's what I love.
Right.
Trace, you mentioned that you hadn't watched the trailer. I vividly recall that there is an image of him running down the hall with the chainsaw in the trailer.
Yeah. In his underwear, in his tidy whiteys and like Adidas or something.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, because in the movie, in the final cut, he's totally naked.
Yeah.
Yeah, Yes. So this is this was okay for the MPAA. They were fine with this.
Sure. Men murdering men, who cares?
I actually do think it was mostly the threesome, which is what got them in trouble with the X rating, which, again, kind of surprising, but whatever.
Yeah. All right, well, let's make our way there. So he disposes of Paul's body in a cab, and at this point he runs into Louis, who, are we meant to think that Louis is having an affair, or is he just out with a beard?
I didn't think he was having an affair, I just thought he was a closet case.
Yeah, that's what I thought too.
Okay.
I also wanted to point out, when he's dragging Paul's body out, that's kind of when you know the otherworldly plane this movie's operating on, because he's dragging the corpse in like a suit. Oh my god, what would you
call it? It's an overnight bag.
There you go. But like, blood is like, he's leaving a trail of blood in the lobby of his apartment complex.
Yeah, and nobody's blinking.
No.
No. So he takes the body back to Paul's apartment, and he then leaves a fake message about how Paul is going to go to the UK for business to help explain why he's absent.
And that was my favorite. It was like his voice, but people are going to buy it. Mm-hmm. It was Patrick Bateman's voice, and it was clearly not him mimicking Paul.
I think that's my favorite joke in this movie, is just the sheer interchangeability of generic white men.
Of everybody. Yes. Yes. Yeah. And again, that's the point, especially in yuppie culture in the 80s.
Yeah.
The homogenization of
everything.
Do y'all think the fact that it is two female writers and a female director, do you think that would have stuck through? I get that it's too much of a hypothetical, but if we have a male director, how does this movie look different? And I'm thinking like maybe a bit, I want to say more stylish, not that this film doesn't have style to it, but like more tricks up their sleeves.
Yeah, I think you're right. Like, when you look at the way that people respond to this film, particularly critics and academics, they 100% credit the way that the film looks and is shot, specifically around violence and violence against women. But I think also the way that it handles the satire and the critique of capitalism, they almost always credit it to Mary Harron. Like, she found that in the book and she drew it out, which just makes it all the more funny, because Bret Easton Ellis, he's like kind of publicly come away from this film in the interim. He doesn't actually think that this is a great adaptation of his book. He thinks that it's too surface level. Like, they should have included more of what's actually in the book in the adaptation.
Yeah, but I don't know how you can do that without making it kind of a slog.
Oh, exactly. Like, he wanted all of the bullshit violence against women that's in the book. He wanted that on screen.
Mm. Well, all right.
Which is why he's a fucking prick. Which is, he supported the film when it came out, and then over the years he's been like, no, I just don't really think it's very good. I don't think it's the best adaptation of my work that could have happened. And you're like, maybe shut up.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
Shut up.
Anyway. Okay, so let's cue our introduction to Donald Kimball, played by Willem Dafoe, who shows up to fall in love with Patrick Bateman over a series of interviews.
They go on dates.
They go on coffee dates. Patrick gets him water.
It's very bizarre. I love Dafoe in this movie, though. I think he has that fucking smile that he just keeps giving constantly. And I also loved it, like, it's never really a conflict in this movie. Like, nothing right. about this murder investigation is actually a conflict.
Nothing. Comes to nothing. Just like the way that Gene's discovery of the book at the end of the film comes to nothing. It's like,
yeah.
Whatever happened to Kimball's investigation? He's basically fine with it.
Yeah, I was trying to think. I think the last time we see him is when they're having their date, right? Like, at the yep. And he's like, oh, like, you're not a suspect, but yeah, it's fine.
Exactly. A fun dialogue in this scene is that when pressed by Kimball to explain what a Yale thing is, Patrick describes Paul Allen as a closet homosexual who probably did a lot of cocaine.
Well, there is a lot of cocaine in this movie, and actually the scene when they do cocaine in the bathroom, I get that that's like that's what you do, but like that was also very homoerotic as the two men are just in the stalls just snorting cocaine right. together.
Well, and there's obviously a gay man in the stall next to them who's next also doing cocaine. I actually thought that that was a gay club, but I could be mistaken.
I did too, because of just the whole way, and there's a runway in it.
But let's be real. I mean,
confirmed gay bar then.
No, I actually thought that it was a drag club too, but it was actually just women. It was just women.
Okay. Because every time we see them in the club, there's, like, men dancing without their shirts on, and they're, like, pressed into really tight formations, and all I could think of was, like, yeah, I've been to that gay bar in the year 2000.
I think maybe they're trying to, like, connect just them, like, their fucking stupid douche bro, white men, homoeroticism shit, like, that. Yeah, that's just what it is.
This is what it looked like in 87.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So after working out to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, he's one of us.
Which we just saw the Child's Play remake do that last year, too. Oh, wait. That was the second one. They showed the second one in that movie.
Ah, okay. I mean, it's good fodder because I feel like it's instantly recognizable, right?
Yes. Yes.
So Patrick then picks up a sex worker for a role play scenario. He will play Paul Allen. She, Christy, she's played by actress Kara Seymour. And then the escort that he orders is Sabrina. And he tries to impress them, and they are not impressed by either his job or his apartment. They really just want to ask how much money he makes.
His line, "Don't you want to know what I do?"
And no. They're both like, no.
Not really. Yeah.
So great.
His delivery of, "I work on Wall Street." It's just so like, ugh.
Uh-huh.
You've heard of PNP? No. Because women just aren't parties. Impressed by this, right? He then lures them into the bedroom with Phil Collins's Susudio, and they engage in a videotape threesome wherein he basically poses and stares at himself in the mirror.
That was really hot, by the way.
It is. I don't find Christian Bale, he's not really my type.
Too old.
Oh my god, though, this scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, even if he's not your type.
The muscles are on full display. We're seeing, but I forgot that we see Bush when he goes, like, tanning later on in the
tanning.
Film.
Yeah, oh.
Yeah.
I pull my magnifying glass out for that shit.
Trace gets right up to the screen. Oh, I think I can see it.
I mean, well, because he's, like, smooth as a baby's ass, except for, the Bush you see in that tanning bed scene.
Yeah. Right.
80s Bush,
this
man, it's real.
This threesome scene, though, is what got the X rating.
This one? Not the other one?
Maybe. Yeah, because he's doing it, like, doggy style in this one.
Right.
Yeah. If I'm remembering correctly, one of the big concerns was not just that it's too graphic, but, like, his disinterest in the women was a mitigating factor where they were like, oh, well, this isn't appropriately sexy and also probably too much thrusting.
Oh, the thrust. I actually think they show this scene in this film as I rated.
Oh, God. So
like
funny.
When they're doing
the
thrust
counter.
I love
the thrust count. Motherfucking MPAA.
But yeah, so, hey, this is fine. I love him looking at himself at the mirror. It's very douchey.
Mm-hmm. It's every Grindr hookup that you've regretted. Yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, pretty much. I mean, I confess, I'm a victim of looking at myself. Like, if I'm at a restaurant with you and, like, the wall behind you is a mirror and I'm talking to you, I'm probably looking at myself in the mirror, like, through you as I talk to you.
Chase doesn't even see people. He just sees reflective surfaces.
Himself. Yeah, exactly. But, okay, so this, I'm actually excited to talk about this, too. So, they do the sexy sex. Yeah. And
then they want to leave.
Yeah, but we don't see this. We don't.
You don't see any of it.
What he does,
which I love.
Yes, and I that has to be a creative decision, like on purpose.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
100%, 100%. Because you just see Sabrina leaving with the bloody nose, right? That's the only clue that he did something to them when they're leaving, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And then when we meet up with Christy the second time, she talks about how he hurt her needing real badly, surgery. And she might need surgery. And you're just like, Jesus Christ! Yeah.
What did he do?
What did he do?
I'm betting that's in the book somewhere, like of whatever he did to them. Oh fuck! Sorry. I also wanted to point out, so whenever he makes Christy get on her hands and knees, and he's like, get down on your knees so Sabrina can see your asshole. Okay, I'm not a fan of using the word asshole, like, to describe an asshole in the literal sense, you know?
And it's not sexy.
No.
No, it's
ass
not.
Ass is sexy. Yeah. Hole right. is maybe sexy. Asshole, yes. not sexy.
No, I agree with you 100%. And then he's like, Sabrina, don't just stare at it. Eat it.
I mean, I did kind of cackle at that.
Yeah.
Oh, I did too.
Like, these poor women have no fucking idea what he wants them to do at any given moment. He is... I apologize because this is offensive to people who actually suffer from it, but he is fucking schizophrenic in this scene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's changing his whims from one moment to the next, and these poor women are trying to stay on top of it. They just want their money.
Right.
I mean, they're professionals. They're professional sex workers.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why they need to unionize so that they can have protection against men like this.
That's right.
So after this scene where we see that Patrick is clearly deranged and he does not like women because he likes to hurt them, we literally get a scene where he's discussing hot women and not attractive women and what they will and will not do for sex with Marcus and McDermott, who is played by Josh Lucas.
Yep.
But I like that this scene is then contrasted where he finds out that Louis has a new business card. He gets irrationally angry, follows him into the bathroom with intent to kill him, mm-hmm. and is mistakenly believed to be a homosexual. And Louis confesses that he has wanted to sleep with Patrick for ages. I love the reversal.
The reveal, though, like he like peels off his black leather glove and just starts mouthing it.
Mm-hmm. And then Patrick has to wash it off. Has to go wash his hands
with the gloves on. Yeah.
You know what? He was social distancing before all of us.
Yeah, that's right.
Wash your hands. Those jokes haven't gotten old in April, have they? Yeah. Anyone?
Oh God.
Yeah. So Patrick leaves immediately.
That's okay. So I don't know. I get that he is not a. Well, I want to say he's not a likable character, you know, but. He's kind of endearing and charming in an asshole way, but...
You're talking about Patrick or Louis?
Patrick.
Okay.
Like, I don't think the movie's asking us to sympathize with him, but I do think that the movie is asking us sometimes to, dare I say, admire him sometimes?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Anyway, so his obscene, extreme disgust towards the mere thought of a homosexual encounter, or actually, do y'all think it was the fact of doing, like, gay shit, or if it was the fact of who it was?
I don't think that at all. I think it's a reversal of expectation. He loses power in this moment because all of a sudden he becomes an object of desire for Louis.
When he's objectified, yeah.
I think if he was legitimately disgusted, he would have killed Louis. And instead, he's just like, oh, shit, this is not what I was expecting. And he bolts because he doesn't know what to do. He's not in control.
Gotcha.
I could be wrong.
No. I mean, that's the beauty of film analysis.
Film analysis.
Critiquing.
Okay. So he goes back to the office and finds Kimball is waiting for him for more banter about food and music. I do think this is very uncomfortable as well, where Patrick suddenly decides that Huey Lewis is too black sounding.
Mm-hmm.
What? So once again, this is a class critique and a racial critique.
Is that just a pretext for Kimball, or are we supposed to believe that he legitimately feels that way?
I was confused because I couldn't figure out if it was because Patrick suddenly heard someone that he considers to be lower class and less than liking the same music as him, and he's like, oh no, I don't like that. But then he still agrees to go on the date with him. Confusion. So Patrick hooks up with Courtney. She is a mess. She is a hot mess. She basically doesn't even know what she wants at this point, and Patrick is not even listening to her, so that's cool. He ends up leaving her to go and hang out with Bryce at a bar where they do coke in the bathroom. And then they have some arbitrary banter with dumb models, where once again, Patrick literally says what's on his mind. He says he's into mergers and executions, and the model mishears him and thinks he's talking about mergers and acquisitions. And I again cackled.
It's so great.
But then they're outside waiting for a cab, and she says, you think I'm dumb, don't you? And it's like, yeah. She doesn't seem dumb when they're talking, but he literally just told you that he murders people and you didn't blink.
And we also, like, man, I need to see those deleted scenes on this Blu-ray, because we don't, I mean, she's dead, but we don't see anything. I guess that's the film's way of saying, like, all right, this is what's par for the course now. So she's dead.
She's dead. He's got a lock of her hair. We'll see her head in the fridge later.
Mm-hmm.
But none of the actual violence.
Right.
We should also mention that at different points, Patrick is also referencing a variety of different famous serial killers. So it's important that he mentions Ed Gein, because, of course, is it Ed Gein or Jeffrey Dahmer that he mentions in this one? Because whichever one left pieces of his victims in the fridge.
Ed Gein and Ted Bundy, he also referenced. Yes.
Okay.
But important to note, apparently the quote he attributes to Gein is actually a quote by Edmund Kemper. So he actually messes it up.
God damn it. Obviously, he was not watching Mindhunters closely enough.
Yeah, Kemper being, he was nicknamed the co-ed killer.
Hmm.
Remember the simpler times when all we had to do was, like, nickname serial killers?
Yeah, not a thing anymore.
Yeah. Do you think serial killers are social distancing?
I would imagine so. I mean, not from the corpses they have hidden in their freezers, but yeah, sure.
Right. They've got friends nearby places. Okay, so this is the point where Jean starts to fall under his trap. She asks for that all-exclusive reservation at Dorcia. God damn it.
I do love the 2 at 8 or 8:30. We don't have anything. Oh, great. No, I told you. We don't have anything.
It's very good. I like it a lot. So he covers his tracks by inviting her to drinks at his place beforehand. He serves her sorbet from the fridge, which has a decapitated head.
Which
in
is
it.
So odd. Like, I love that the sorbet is the amuse-bouche to dinner at Dorcia.
I'm telling you again, Brian Fuller got everything from Hannibal from this film. It's heads in fridges with sorbet as an aperitif.
It really does make sense. And I was like, oh, you could do a double feature, or just, you know, watch all three seasons of Hannibal and then just cap it off with American Psycho as your aperitif.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh. It's a lovely. Oh, I should have said it's an amuse-bouche, not an aperitif. Okay.
Anyway, oh, yes. God, yes, right.
Have I learned nothing about French cuisine? So I actually think that this is one of the best sequences in the film.
With Jean?
Yeah, because it actually gives her something to do, but you spend, I mean, the comedy is kind of off the chains because she's just talking. She's completely unaware of the danger she's in. He's surveilling all of the different things that he can use to murder this poor woman with. He finally settles on a fucking high-powered nail gun that he almost shoots into the back of her head until Evelyn calls and leaves a fucking message on the answering machine. It's terrifying and funny in equal measures, and I just think it's so successful.
And why do you think he spares her, you guys? I mean, is it because she's truly, like, the only character who semi-hears him, who's actually listening to a certain extent?
I've always wondered about this, because, and honestly, I always wondered about why he was going to kill her in the first place. Because, yes, she is the closest thing to a friend he has in his life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it always bothered me. Like, I could support most of the stuff he does up until this point. but yeah, when he turns on her, I was like, oh, that sucks. Like, you're kind of a dickhead. So I don't know.
This is the second person he considered killing that he spares. So
right.
It seems like the people who display vulnerability are the people who he ends up ultimately letting get away.
But in this particular scene, though, it's the phone call from Evelyn and the voicemail. It ruins his groove. Like, it wakes him back up into the world of reality or something.
Yeah. Right, right.
But they still have, a conversation after this. Like, it's not as though it goes from the phone call to then Gene leaving the apartment.
Right.
I mean, I don't disagree with you. I absolutely think without the phone call, Gene would have just been dead.
But, but why do you think he was gonna kill her then? Do you think it is just because she asked for Dorcia, and when he knew he couldn't get them in, he couldn't be embarrassed like that, so he'd rather kill her than, have her see that he couldn't get him into Dorcia?
I think that's the easy joke, for sure. I joked earlier, the minute she says Dorcia, she's basically got a kill me sign on her head, but... Mm-hmm. I also just think at this point, his bloodlust is amping up. He's looking at everyone as a potential victim.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Listeners, weigh in with your thoughts. Why do you think Gene is spared execution from the high-powered nail gun? Okay, so the next day, he's got his date with Kimball, and this is where we discover that he actually has an alibi for Paul Allen's murder. So the guys that he always goes out with claim that he was out to dinner with them, and also that apparently Paul Allen has been spotted in the UK and is doing just fine, even though it can't be corroborated. So this is where we start to get very, Tracy mentioned earlier that there are subtle hints. This is where we again start to get that, is it happening or is it maybe in his mind?
And I guess we can wait until the actual ending to discuss that, but yeah.
Sure, yeah. So this is unfortunately where poor Christine, the sex worker, re-enters our narrative. He tracks her down at night. She confesses that she might need surgery. He lures her back into his cab with a fat wad of cash, and they meet up with...
I got a fat wad for you.
Fat wad. I mean, that was a lot of money that he was flashing.
It was. I would have gotten in the back of that car, too.
I mean, I feel like we've all gotten into the back of cabs for less than that.
Right.
Yeah.
Give me a sandwich.
Ooh, is that prosciutto? Yes, I'll get in the back. This is where he picks up Elizabeth, who is not even a sex worker. It is apparently a casual acquaintance of his.
Yes. And this is Guinevere Turner, the co-screenwriter, mm-hmm. as Eric mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. This scene is so uncomfortable to watch. Because you see Christy just sitting there, nursing her wine, looking like she would rather be anywhere else.
Yeah, she looks ready to bolt.
Yes. Meanwhile, Elizabeth is getting drugged by whatever he put in the wine.
Well, and she's so obtuse. You know, she wants to call her friend. She wants the number. She doesn't need the address. Elizabeth,
cocaine,
read
like
the room.
Else this movie does.
All I could think of was the line from Ghost where Whoopi is like, Molly, you in danger, girl.
Okay, so this scene in the book, just so y'all know what he does to them in the book. So first of all, what he's doing to her under those fucking covers, he's eating her vagina off. Like, he bites it off.
Yeah, I heard about something
like
that.
He reaches down Elizabeth's throat and pulls out her throat to where her head caves, like her neck disappears. So her head caves into that.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's really fucked up. And then he proceeds to decapitate Christy and put her mouth hole on his boner and walk around the apartment with her decapitated head hanging from his dick.
Right.
Now I feel cheated.
So Mary Harron read that and said, no.
Maybe not.
It's really the neck caving in that really gets me. Decapitated head on the dick.
I mean, I don't need vaginas being bitten off either.
No. I don't need any of it. But I think the visual of shoving his hand down her throat, pulling it out to her head, just caves into her shoulders. That image is haunting.
And is that even possible? I mean, can you pull out someone's throat?
I don't know. But Bret Easton Ellis thinks you can. or maybe it's also supposed to be part of his fantasy life.
Right. Oof. Right.
He did say that at the time when the film was getting made, he had been living with someone for 10 years and his partner apparently could not read the book.
I mean, it's, again, this threesome scene is three or four pages and the violence is like two of them.
Yeah.
I also do love when he's trying to get them to do stuff, Elizabeth's like, I'm not a lesbian. And then it like smash cuts to them making out on the couch.
Yeah.
Right, right. And I think Guinevere is really a lesbian in real life.
I think so, yeah.
That would make sense. Good for her. Good queerness. Is Mary Harron a lesbian? Do we know?
She is not. She is married with a husband.
Gotcha. Do y'all think he was always going to kill them, or do you think it's them mocking his love of Whitney Houston that sets him off?
Oh, no.
No, I think he was going to kill them.
He was going to kill them no matter what.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know that the Whitney Houston mockery helped. Especially if we read into it, like you suggested, Trace, that he is threatened by references to homosexuality. He would not appreciate being called a Whitney Houston fan.
Correct.
That is true. That is true.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so we do not get vaginal biting or throat caving in. What we do get is some kind of violence under the sheets from Christie's point of view. The sheet is just
red. That we cannot see.
But it's almost more disturbing because you're just left to your imagination. Like, what has he done to her under that sheet?
Well, it's one of those things where it's like the sound, where it's like morphs from screams of ecstasy pleasure to screams of pain. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's like when you realize the switch, that's kind of what's so disturbing about it.
Mm-hmm. Which is basically what Patrick Bateman is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Half the time he's regular and displaying perfection on the outside, and the other half of the time he's a fucking homicidal maniac.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he proceeds to chase Christie through the apartment with a chainsaw. Basically, it turns into Friday the 13th. She's just finding pounds and piles of bodies in all sorts of different places.
You say that. I think it's a Halloween homage from when Laurie Strode is going around all the neighborhoods, knocking on the doors, and no one helps her.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh. Yeah.
Okay.
Because that's a commentary on, you know, middle class suburbia and how people don't really care about each other. Whereas this is correct. The exact same thing, but in fucking Wall Street, New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And of course, the chainsaw harks back to our earlier scene where he's watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So we're basically hitting all the slasher classics with this scene.
Until we don't see her die.
Which I'm totally fine with. I love the fact that she almost gets away. She makes it all the way down to the stairwell. And he is so nonchalant that he just laissez-faire lets go of his chainsaw and kills her at the bottom.
It's so great.
It is.
It's so great. Yeah.
But it feels, again, like the combination of comedy and horror, because it's so ridiculous that you could drop a chainsaw down, what, 6 flights of stairs and actually kill someone with it? But it's horrifying at the same time, because I think credit the actress, because I really feel for Christie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
I actively want her to get away because she does not deserve this from him.
No, she doesn't. She's very sympathetic.
But then you have it coupled with, like, because, like, as he's watching her go down the stairs, you can see him, like, pointing the chainsaw at her, and he's, like, moving in a circle as she goes down the stairs. There's a lot of physical comedy in this movie that I feel like people don't really pay attention to or, like, don't talk about. But, like, even just something as simple as that, where he's like, oh, just gotta make sure I get my timing right on this drop.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Basically just, like, a funhouse game for him. Make sure you release at the right time.
Right. Mm-hmm.
God. So this is more or less the point where he has gone off the rails. So he tries to break up with Evelyn at lunch the next day. He literally tells her the truth. He's drawing disturbing imagery on the table, and she is not paying attention at all.
The line is, you're just not terribly important to me.
So apparently Reese Witherspoon ad-libbed the scene where she kind of freaks out, and then it turns out that she's actually just calling to the woman that she sees across the restaurant with the attractive bracelet.
Oh, that's amazing.
Good old Reese. So she gets very upset. He does ultimately successfully break up with her after multiple attempts. And he goes...
Sorry, we haven't really mentioned it, but there is a recurring motif of the excuses he makes to get out of things where he has to go return some videotapes.
Videos,
Apparently it became a meme on the internet. Like, it's one of the most kind of gift or memed images from the film that people use online.
Oh, that's funny. I want to steal that shit.
It apparently will not be difficult for you to find.
I mean, there you go.
So he goes to take out more money at the cash machine, and this is where we get the clearest indication that he is hallucinating, or we cannot trust him as an unreliable narrator, because the screen of the ATM encourages him to feed it a stray cat.
So I always thought this was like the very end of the movie, but there's still like 20 minutes left.
Mm-hmm. There is.
It's kind of a blur to me, even now. Again, having just watched it an hour ago.
Yeah, you're like, we're at the climax, right?
I mean, yeah, it's basically bam, bam, bam. Feed the ATM the cat, shoot the woman, run from the police, confess to the lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Like, that's all it is.
Yeah. We should say, though, when he shoots the police officers, the police cruiser explodes, and it looks exactly like every generic 80s action movie you've ever seen. And there's a moment where Patrick actually looks at the gun like, oh, wow, did I do that? That's crazy. I didn't expect that at all. And that's another cue that you're meant to question whether or not everything is actually happening in his mind or if it's happening in real life.
Well, correct. I guess, too, because I leave out he goes to Jared Leto's apartment, and yeah, mm-hmm. it's like moved out and everything.
Yeah, that's the next day. So he calls his lawyer, he confesses to all the murders, but it's on an answering machine. And then the next day he gets up, he pretends like everything's fine, but when he goes to Paul Allen's house, it's been completely cleaned, it's being shown to prospective renters, and he's very confused. Now, I did see an interesting piece online where people have said, oh, so this is confirmation he absolutely was imagining everything. Someone speculated that because the view of Paul Allen's apartment was so nice and it was so obviously rich, like every time people go into it, they comment about how expensive it is, that mm-hmm. he actually did commit those murders. He did leave those bodies in there, and the building covers it up. They just want to immediately rent it out so that they don't have to deal with the scandal, which I had never considered.
That's interesting. And the way that the realtor treats him, too, you know, might support that as well.
Yeah.
She doesn't want any trouble, and she tells him not to come back. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I can see that theory.
It's not like she's saying, oh, no, you're confused, or, oh, okay, sorry, you'll have to rebook an appointment. She tries to bait him with the, where did you see the ad? No, I didn't actually put an ad there.
Right.
So, I don't know, food for thought.
No, I literally never crossed my mind, so that's good.
Yeah. So he calls Gene, he has a public meltdown, he shows up for drinks with the boys, at which point he sees Harold, his lawyer, who naturally mistakes him for someone else, because that's literally what happens in this movie at every possible encounter. So again, this is potential confirmation that he actually did make the call, he actually did commit the murders, because Harold goes from not recognizing him to reassuring him that Patrick couldn't possibly do that because Patrick is so boring and stale, but also that he recently had dinner with Paul Allen in London. So some people say, oh, well, that's confirmation. Paul Allen is alive. He's in London. But other people said, well, how can we trust anything that Harold says? He doesn't even know who he's talking
to. Right. Everybody's mistaking everybody else. So, yeah.
Does he even know who Paul Allen is? We don't know.
Correct.
Okay. At this point, this is where Jean starts to discover that there's more to her boss than she expected. So after the phone call, she goes into his office, she looks at his day planner, and she finds really graphic and disturbing drawings. And these support all of the activities that he talked about when he made the confession.
He's not a very good drawer. I mean, they're just like stick figures that have been like dismembered.
I mean, he works on Wall Street, Trace. He didn't go to art school.
Well, I mean, it is serial killer scratch, so I mean...
it 100% is, yeah. Do y'all like that we don't get anything more from her at this point, though? Like, oh, she just sees it, revealed, she knows, that's it.
I kind of love the open-endedness, because the final scene is we're at the bar, he's there with all the boys, and they're listening to Reagan's address, and Bryce, the Justin Theroux character, he makes a comment about how you can't trust Reagan because there's like the surface level and then what's actually happening underneath. This prompts Patrick's final voiceover, which is basically that he's the exact same way, but that his confession has meant nothing. And it ends on this note of ambiguity where you don't know whether Patrick was telling the truth and he was committing all these murders or if he's deluded. But yeah, we actually have no idea what happens next either. Does he just go back to the office? Does he resume life carefree because he's going to get away with Paul Allen's murder and everybody else? Does Jean turn him in? Does she quit? The film isn't actually interested in answering any of those questions.
Nope, it's not.
But I think it's the right decision, because what would satisfy? To do anything more would be to confirm which way you're meant to believe. And Mary Harron and
Bret Easton Ellis, or Guinevere Turner?
Guinevere Turner, yeah. So the two women were very adamant that they didn't want to give people the reassurance one way or another.
Right. Which I like.
People misconstrue the ending all the time. Like, they take people's confusion to mean, oh no, he's actually crazy. He didn't commit any of the murders.
I see.
And see, yeah, for me, it's like, it doesn't matter. Even trying to give an answer to that question, I mean, like you said, yeah, it wouldn't have been satisfying had they actually given an answer. But the point of the film is not to have the answer. It's just this fucking
right.
crazy
yeah.
person.
Well, I think it's more scary, too, if you want to think about it. This monster is hiding in plain sight. He's going out for drinks. He's buying new embossed business cards. He's buying the latest fashions. He's taking women out to Dorsia and other fancy restaurants. He's just out there mingling in high society and probably also murdering 20 to 40 people. Maybe. Right.
I mean, it's not only an indictment of, you know, 1980s yuppie culture, but I think it's an indictment of society today where mm-hmm. people truly see what they want to see, you know?
Yeah.
What's the saying, when a tiger shows you his stripes, you're supposed to believe him? And we kind of live in this society where you have psychotic people clearly illustrating that they're psychotic people, but not everybody sees them as psychotic. And mm-hmm. here we are.
Here yep. you are with a orange Cheeto president. There's no resemblance to anything.
I do think that, yeah, what this movie is satirizing is never going to not be timely.
Yeah.
It's right. always going to be a relevant film, which I think is probably the biggest feat that the film accomplishes.
Which is yeah. crazy, though, when you think about it, because the 80s was such a specific period for conservatism and corporate greed. And, you know, that's how we end up with things like The Wolf of Wall Street and all these other texts. Right. Like, the 80s is really steeped in this idea. And yet,
yeah.
as you suggested, both of you, these are timeless ideas and they completely resonate with both the current ideology that we're living in. But I think, like you could say, it worked in the 90s and it worked in the 2000s as
right.
well.
Right. Agreed. Mm-hmm.
I also think there's something safe about having this film be set in the 80s, where we can put the rose-colored blinders on and say, well, it's not so bad now.
Sure.
It makes yeah, it right. almost safer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it gives you that distance and you can laugh at it without really being so self-aware that it's, you know, the same shit, different decade.
Truly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I really ended up appreciating this film a lot more on the rewatch. I hadn't watched it since I saw it in theaters in 2000. And
mm-hmm. oh, wow.
I remember being confused and I didn't fully grasp the satire. So I felt like the film had an imbalance of tones that didn't really work for me as a viewer. So actually paying attention and looking for the critique and seeing how sharp the writing is. And
yes.
obviously the performance by Bale is immaculate, but mm-hmm. I really feel like what I took away was that the screenplay and the direction for this film is kind of masterclass. Everything that they're trying to accomplish, they're achieving with the script and the direction.
Yes. And it's so self-assured in its tone. Even if people don't like the tone, it's very clear what it is.
Yeah. Like, this yeah. is not a feel-good film, but I think it's a very successful film.
Yes.
And that's kind of, I mean, I'll just reiterate what I said at the beginning of the episode. You know, like, I think it's well-made. I think it does what it tries to do very well. I think Bale's great. I can't tell you why. I don't dislike this movie. I like it fine, but it's just not something I enjoy watching. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard for mm-hmm. me to get past that barrier.
Yeah.
Right.
I don't know that you could say it's like an enjoyable film in that sense, right? Like, it's hard to watch.
But even going back to Martyrs, you know, I don't enjoy watching Martyrs, but that's still a 5 out of 5 for me, you know? So I can't tell you why that works for me and it connects with me more and this doesn't, you know?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Trace, out of 5, what would this be for you?
I might give it a 3. It's a 3 out of 5. Because, again, I don't think it's bad. It's probably, for me, really a 4, but just because I just can't really connect with it, it's like, it's a 3. I like okay. it. I would tell people to watch it, but it's not like one where I'm like, oh, it's so good!
Okay. And Eric, what about you? What would you rate this?
A solid 4, if not 4.5 for mm-hmm. me.
Okay.
But let's go with the 4.
Yeah.
all right. I'm going to come in at the top end. I'm thinking this is like a 4.5 out of 5 for me.
God. And you're real, like, stingy with your fucking rating, so.
This is true. As folks discovered when they listened to our flawless 5-star episode on Patreon last month.
Yes, 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 they did. You have way less 5-star films than I do. My 5-star films are a bit bloated on my letterbox.
This is true. You're a generous lover of the 5 stars. No.
Well, I think that's going to wrap up American Psycho. So before we announce what we're covering next week, Eric, do you want to plug anything? Tell us what you're doing. What's coming up? I mean, I know about some of them, but I don't really know the status.
Well, Nicole Snyder, my writing partner, and I just finished co-writing a new horror movie with Richard Shepard. It's called Her Name is Retribution. Ooh. We set it up at Sony, and it's another really twisty, turny, fucked up horror film. And this one, I think, makes the perfection look like a Disney movie. So this really goes for it. So I don't know. We had a blast writing it. It took us almost a year to write and rewrite. And I want to say that it's like similar in its DNA to The Perfection, where it almost feels like it's three or four different movies in one, but it all makes sense at the end. So I don't know. I'm excited to shoot it and to unleash it on the world. So it was really fun to write.
Very good.
It's fun. And if people want to follow you online, how would they get a hold of you?
I'm on Twitter. God, I don't even know what my handle is. I'm really bad with social media.
You're in the business. You have to get better at
social media.
I know.
I'm really, really, really bad. It's embarrassing. And Nicole's even worse. Like, I think she's just on Instagram and that's it because she likes pictures.
So listeners, I can confirm that you can follow Eric at Charmsies.
That's right. Yeah. At Charmsies. Yes.
And we'll link to you in the show notes.
Yeah.
I'm dying right now. Okay, well, if you would like to contact us, you can visit our Horror Queers Facebook page or join our exclusive Horror Queers Facebook group. Tweet the show at Horror Queers or email us at horrorqueers@gmail.com. If you have 2 seconds, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a rating or a review. You can also go to TeePublic, that is TeePublic.com, and search for Horror Queers to get merchandise like t-shirts, stickers, mugs, pillows, and other shit. If you want even more content, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/horrorqueers. You'll get exclusive bonus episodes. Well, we usually cover recent horror films, but because there are no recent films coming out.
Ba-dum-bum-bing.
Yeah, we're doing a house horror theme this month and covering a bunch of really, really fun house horror films like The Strangers, Mike Flanagan's Hush, and a commentary on Adam Wingard's You're Next.
Woohoo.
Really fun. Joe.
Mm-hmm.
What are we covering next week? Because I actually don't know.
Well, the calendar configuration is creeping up on a certain date that celebrates getting a little high. So in honor of 420, we're going to take a look at Reefer Madness, the more contemporary version featuring one Kirsten Bell.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. I forgot about this. Yes. Everyone, it's amazing. It is Reefer Madness the movie musical, which was a Showtime adaptation of the original 1930s Reefer Madness propaganda film. We've got Christian Campbell, who is Nev's brother. We've got Nev Campbell. We've got Anna Gasteyer, Steven Weber, Alan Cumming playing like 10 roles. There's Jesus. Oh my God. Jesus smoking weed. And it's a musical. And it's super fucking fun. Oh, and there's cannibalism in it. And there's a song called Murder. So please seek this movie out, even if you don't like musicals, because it's a fucking hoot and a half. And get stoned.
Yeah. I'm interested to check it out based on your description. I've never seen this. You gave me a hard sell and said I was not allowed to veto, so we are gonna watch Reefer Madness, the movie
It
musical.
Was either this or Shrooms, and I promise you this is gonna be the better watch. So, anyway, on that note, we can cross out American Psycho.
Yes, and cross out Horror Queers.
A bloody disgusting podcast network. Home of creepy, disturbing, and terrifying creepypastas. SCP Archives. Weekly full cast storytelling. Horror Queers. Genre commentary from an LGBTQ perspective. And the Boo Crew. For horror-centric interviews. Listen free wherever you stream audio and at bloodydisgusting.com/podcasts.